It's the third episode of Prospect Central here on Sportsnet 650. We've made it to three boys, Cam Robinson, Ryan Beach, and myself, Seth T.R. Shaw. I mean, Ryan, we've been doing this radio thing for a little while now, but we made it to three. Three episodes, and we haven't been canceled yet. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's usually a good sign. We talk a few times a week. I think I talk to you more often than I talk to some of my friends.
I don't know if that's a good or bad thing.
It's a budding relationship over there.
We're going to have a lot of fun talking prospects, of course, and we'll get to some underrated prospects. But one of the things that we wanted to kind of start the show off today is kind of talk about the process. We went through two episodes breaking down the top 31, 32 prospects in the draft. But now it's kind of time to kind of talk about what each of you guys go through in putting these rankings together, what traits you look for, how you come to an overall grade, and how you put players in tiers. And one of the things I'm fascinated about, Cam, is also where the game is trending, and not only looking at what traits work for today, but what about tomorrow's NHL. But just generally, where do you start with your process? Like, what's the first thing you want to do when you start putting this together?
For sure. And so it is quite a process anyways. You know, I usually try to stay away from looking at players the year ahead, just because I usually have my hands full with the current draft eligible kids. But it is hard not to see some of the 2020s or 2021s coming up. But excuse me, when I start putting the list together right after the draft, basically, as I sit down, I want to see a player a couple of times, try to not look too closely at some of the smaller plays and just watch a player or two each game and just kind of get a feel for what they're all about. And then, of course, you know, I talk about this all the time and in my rankings and on the show here is that I just place an immense value on skating ability. And, you know, basically what comes down to is hockey IQ or processing speed. And so, you know, we can dig into this a whole lot deeper as we go through. But those are the two real major things. And I think that's where the game is already at. And it's been heading there for a little while, is that can you keep up with the play? Because every game, every season, we see it in the playoffs, it ramps up a whole nother gear, is that if you can't keep up, like there's not a place for you in the game anymore. And if your feet can keep up, that's a start, but can you see the play happen? Can your hands keep up with it? Can your mind, can you get to those areas of the ice to be successful? And if you can't do that, then you're not going to be successful offensively, or if you're a defenseman, you're probably not going to be playing up the lineup either.
Yeah, for me personally, it's a little bit different of a process. Luckily, through the help of some other people, I'm able to kind of access data to kind of look at prospects for the year ahead. So generally, once the conclusion of the, you know, the draft happens, I kind of look at what's the next class and kind of, you know, map out where players are going to be and kind of try to figure out how to, you know, manage the viewings and then kind of go from there. This year in particular, I've obviously been a little bit more focused on the WHL. So I've been able to kind of get notes on more of the 2020 guys and some of the 2021 guys in those limited viewings, but then, you know, it's all kind of mapping it out. And then as the year kind of goes along, you know, you kind of just take notes and add, you know, onto the pile of information as much as you can and then kind of loop in. So you may be focusing on player X for a game, but if player Y stands out to you on another team and you know that you need to kind of get some viewings on him, you take some notes about his play in general terms and then kind of come back and focus on it. So it's all that kind of delicate balance of trying to figure out how to get as many views as possible.
And it's really not just looking at the numbers and just not looking at the games, right, Ryan? Like, one of the things that we've talked a lot about in the past, too, is the analytics help you to a great degree, but you also have to kind of watch the players to understand the context. And when you try to go through that context, like how many games do you feel like you have to kind of go through and how long do you have to look at a guy before you get to a good idea?
I think generally, you know, it takes probably at least three viewings of a player to kind of get the basic understanding of what they are. I think at about five or six games, you can kind of pinpoint the positives and the negatives about their games. And then 8 to 10 games, you kind of can become more of a, for lack of a better term, an expert on what they are. You can kind of get into the more the minutia and the details about them. And I think you're absolutely right with your first point, is that when it comes to the data specifically, it's never anything that's used for the judgment or decisions in the sense that, you know, how you're going to do it, but it's more about guiding where your eye can be, guiding how you're going to be able to spend your time and focusing on certain things. So that can help, and it can help you find, you know, players that might not stand out and at the beginning of the year, and then by the end of the year, everyone's talking about them. So you can kind of, you know, be a little bit more confident in your viewings about player X or Y when they've kind of started to rise up the rankings.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because, you know, as Ryan alluded to, there is that we have different processes at the beginning, and he uses some of those analytics, and I love it because I'm kind of the opposite, where I'm using quote unquote the eye test. I'm watching players. I'm always looking for underlying stats, and I'm very much open to finding out all those micro stats and stuff. But it's really good for me, and it's been great for me. And with what Beach and Jeremy Davis are doing right now with Next Gen Hockey, there is that after I have a really nice clear picture of a player, or you know, an abundance of players, after having 6, 8, 10 views more for some of these guys, is that then I get to go in and I really get to see and check out their models that they built and get those micro stats, and that can paint, you know, kind of provide another vantage point to maybe some things that I missed on a guy that, you know, oh, look at this guy, he's his numbers really reflect well with his cohorts, and you know, maybe I have to go back and I have to look closer at some of these plays that he's been making, and did I miss something? So it really offers kind of an extra glimpse that you can go back and you can reflect yourself. Is, you know, it all depends. Everyone has an off night. Everyone has an off shift. So when you're watching a player, that might greatly impact where you view them and where they're going to transfer forward versus if you saw them the night before. Maybe it's the third game in 4 nights or something like that for some of these USHL kids, and you don't get their best game. And so that's why it's important to get many views and then to get looks from other angles, and the analytics side of that is huge.
Well, and your eyes can also deceive you sometimes. It's really interesting how the mind works, and we are all human, and that means we are prone to error and also biases to some degrees. And I've had this happen before in the past where I look at a guy and I see a really good play in a certain way, and I'm like, okay, this guy's good at this. And then you kind of don't maybe notice some of the other times where that same sequence happens and it's not positive, but it doesn't stand out negatively. And then you go through, look at the numbers, and you're like, wait, this is kind of telling me I'm wrong here somewhere. Then you go back and watch, and sometimes you realize, okay, you were wrong, and sometimes you realize, okay, well, this was just bad luck, and this is why these numbers look the way they do.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think sometimes it can, you know, force you to look at things differently. And, you know, at the start of the year, that's how I guide what I'm going to do, and then when it comes into the middle of the year, you kind of have more, you know, the draft season application is important because, you know, there's going to be a difference in roles compared to their draft minus ones. Like, there's lots of WHL players CHL players who are going to get a larger opportunity because their teams are crappy, or there's players that are just, you know, basically barely playing as a 16-year-old. So there's going to be differentiations through there. And then what you can use is that, you know, once you kind of have a benchmark, which is usually, you know, January-ish, you have a reasonable sample size to kind of look at how the season is trending. And then also you can kind of get more into the more tracked data, whether that's zone entries, zone exits, and see how they're doing it. And I'll use this as an example. Someone pointed out to me is that Lucas Alvanin's the prospect with the Vegas Golden Knights. He's obviously taking a huge step forward, but he fell down, if I recall correctly, the fifth round. And you know, and everyone's looking back on why it was. And one of the things that stood out for him is that he had really strong zone entries in terms of, you know, successfully gaining the line and maintaining possession. But if you watched him during his draft season, it didn't always seem to jive with it. And that's kind of a combination of which games you're watching, how that, you know, how he's playing or things like that. So those are kind of the things that help you kind of, you know, focus in on specific parts and different attributes that can set players apart.
Yeah, for sure. And you're right. They can be misleading for sure. And your eyes can be misleading, and so can the numbers. And so, you know, you look at a player that can get and gain the zone with a lot of efficiency and frequency, but what are they doing with the puck after that? So, you know, do they have great speed? Are they a toolsy player where they can burn down straight down the wing, north, south, and gain entry in the zone? But are they just blindly throwing into the middle? Or are they circling the net and losing possession? What are they doing with that puck? So the next thing that's so important is, you know, poise, patience, and can they make good plays to good spots on the ice? So that usually takes some confidence, and it happens literally all over the rink. You know, can a forward take a puck off the wall, quickly see the best available option and hit a center with a pass or move it up the wall? Can a defenseman survey the ice on their way back to retrieve a puck and draw on a forechecker and make the smart transitional play all in a hurry? These little things, these little plays that happen all over the ice, those are really very telling for a player. And are they doing it in junior? Are they doing it in the second league in Finland? You know, are they doing it against men even as a draft eligible? But every step up the ladder to the AHL, to the NHL, it's going to be quicker. Things are going to happen. If you can't process the game at that speed, if you can't make those plays and see the things develop in front of you, you're not going to be able to succeed. So that's where that hockey sense really comes into play. And I think that that's something that you can see analytically, and that your eyes can definitely pick up on as well.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in hockey sense, and you can see it in analytics to some degree, but also you can really sense it when you watch a player, and that's where the eye test coming in is really positive as well, because you know, I don't want to harp on Jake Virtanen, for instance, but he does have some limitations, and you kind of see it happen when he gets set up in the offensive zone, and it's like he doesn't quite know how to make the next read or where to go next. But what he's great at is gaining zone entries, and he's so good at dragging the puck in, and his possession numbers always look positive. But it's almost a little bit like the David Booth factor, where Booth also had good underlying numbers, and you kind of wonder why he wasn't scoring, and then you realize, well, he just did one thing really well, and that was carry the puck throughout the zone and gain zone entry and just kind of mess around with it for a while. And then you see other players when they're set up, and then you can watch them read and react and play off your teammates. That is a lot more evident when you actually watch those guys. And it's easier to kind of figure out that these shot charts, Ryan, they look great for a player, but sometimes it also tells you he's one-dimensional in how he plays, and you have to look a bit wider to understand where that hockey sense is.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's kind of the layers of analysis to look into it. And I think, personally, hockey sense is something I value greatly for obviously the simple ability of, you know, how he can read and react to what's happening around him and on the ice and think the game, you know, try to think the game one step ahead. But also the fact that, in my opinion, I think people, you know, players that have a higher hockey IQ can also understand their deficiencies and work to make them better. They're not just going to kind of sit on their laurels. They're going to understand and be more approachable in terms of learning and coaching and, you know, those kind of attributes to make themselves better. So that's something that generally sticks out to me when watching players, is that if, you know, if a player is a really smart player, I would, you know, lean towards the thought process that, you know, they're going to also understand the things that they need to do and be better coachable.
Yeah, it's funny. We talk about players, you know, who the puck just seems to follow around. And last week, Ryan said that it, you know, it's an odd compliment to give to a player, but it's so valid because those players are usually around the puck for a reason. They see where the play is going and they get themselves into that position. And yeah, it's similar to like a poker player. It's a luck-based game, but for the most part, you see there's always the same handful of these people at the final tables. It's because skill is so vital. So the puck inevitably lands on those type of players' sticks because they're the guys, they have it for a reason. They see the plays, they get themselves into those positions, they make everyone around them better just by having that poise, that confidence, and that ability to read the play. You know, Gretzky always said it, right? Don't go where the puck is, go where it's going to be. It's that legendary quote from him, but it's one of these things that it's hockey sense. It's one of the most difficult skills to really hone in on. And I don't think anyone has a single definition for it. And it kind of also makes it the most interesting because each scout's going to interpret it a little bit differently. They're all going to see things a little bit differently in different situations. And it's just, When it comes down to it, it's just, can you process information quickly? And it's a very difficult skill to improve. You know, you can put players in battle drills and small ice surfaces and in practice, and you'll put them in those intense game-like situations and have them battle and roll it out over and over. And hopefully you watch them learn before your eyes, you know, the mistakes that they make each time. But I really believe it's one of those innate skills that some people have and some people do not. And so, you know, just being an average skater and making that a plus is something we don't see every day, but it is achievable. But for a player, if they're 17, 18, 19 years old and they don't have the ability to read and process quickly, it's very, very difficult. I don't know too many players who've really elevated it to a level where they're at the NHL and they're succeeding with that hockey sense.
Yeah, it's that processing speed that really matters, right? Because if you can process the information that comes at you quickly right there on the spot, you can have some success if you are athletically gifted and you work hard and you have some skills. Sometimes you don't process quickly, but you're really good at sitting after the fact, break things down with a little bit more time. And that just means people are a bit different in how they process the information. But that's also some of the things you look for when you're trying to separate good from great to bad prospects. And one thing Ryan mentioned, which I absolutely love as well, and this is harder to figure out because you know, we don't get a chance to sit down with all these players individually to really dig into what they're like personally. But if a player is relatively smart, understands what he's good or bad at, chances are he's going to work on making that better as long as he is driven. And that's such a big part of things. How big of a hockey nerd is a player?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're obviously speaking in general terms of that because not every player is going to be the same or every mm-hmm. person, but I think that's an important part. And, you know, kind of looping it into Canucks context, as I look at someone like Troy Stetcher, you know, he's a smaller defenseman. There's so many things kind of working against him, but he's such a smart and driven kid. He wants to be better every single day. And we've kind of seen that natural progression, and that's the kind of players that you want, especially in the later rounds, of players that are going to kind of, you know, be driven, but also figure out what their issues are and work every single day to be better. And those are kind of the things that will jump out. And unfortunately, we don't have that access because we don't have, you know, can't interview all these kids. Right. But that's kind of the things that it also kind of plays into the process as well.
No, for sure. And I admit that very quickly that I'm limited in that sense that I'm not getting to sit down with these players and getting to chat with their coaches and finding out, you know, what type of person is this? You know, have they ever faced any adversity? You know, a lot of these kids, they come from well-off families because hockey's become a kind of an elitist sport. They've gone to, you know, all the best academies. They've usually been the best player on their team forever. And then they get to this stage of the game and have they ever faced adversity and do they know how to deal with it successfully? So, you know, maybe you've achieved really high metrics, but you don't have a great straight skating stride. And, you know, because of that, you're like, well, my numbers are there. I'm putting up great numbers. I'm not going to work on it. That adversity, like maybe it's going to come a little too late and you're not going to be able to keep up. A really prominent NHL scout, just we were having a chat just recently and he said, you know, you need the total package of information. And that's the part that many people misunderstand. So it's easy to look at the stats, even the micro stats, but you know, on ice is just one small dimension of what they look at. And so, you know, how the game you see today translate, you know, how it takes many influences, starting with, you know, how these kids are made up physically and emotionally. Can they deal with things as they come at them? And emotional maturity is so big too, because like I said, some of these kids have never faced any before. They've never been cut from a team. And so when they're 17 or 18 and maybe they fall out of the first round or they get sent back from camp early and they move up to the NCAA and they're having struggles in their freshman year, is, you know, do they give up? You know, do they want to move to the O or do they want to dig their heels in and really improve and find areas to make themselves better and succeed, you know, turn that flaw into a plus. And I think that's very telling in a player's makeup and how they're going to translate at the next level.
Yeah. And there's such a gray area. And as much as people in general, humans don't like to admit they can be wrong. And there's a lot of luck and unknown variables that go into it. And that is development, especially when you're drafting 18-year-olds, sometimes 17, you know, obviously sometimes overagers who are 19 years old. But so much can happen in life and in a player's career, emotionally, professionally. Who do you interact with? What type of coaches do you have? How do you fit in with your first team? There's so many unpredictable variables that go into player development that you can sometimes even make sure that you've gone through every checklist and you feel super confident about a player, but it may not come together because the reality is there's a lot of things that we don't know and we simply can't predict.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important part that kind of Cam touched on there, is the biases, and that mm-hmm. kind of plays all into it. And, you know, someone like myself who probably, you know, uses data a little bit more just because I have it available to me, is that I try to use all that data to eliminate biases and then kind of, you know, figure out ways to get better on every single, you know, viewing or whatever it is. And, you know, a player that stands out to me from this draft class is that I've constantly been checking back on is Braden Tracy with the Moose Jaw Warriors. I've watched a lot of him because of Jet Wu with the Warriors. So I kind of had a good sense of what he was as a player watching from the eye test. And he just kind of keeps bumping up in terms of the underlying numbers just because of how well he produced. But there's those, you know, those biases kind of play into it, is that, you know, you kind of want a player who hustles all the time. And you know, no matter, every time I watch him, no matter what he did, I still kept coming back to that bias of thinking that he wasn't doing that, or, you know, creating offense on his own. And then you also want to try to avoid recency bias and try not to put too much weight in it. But he had a pretty strong U18s, and that kind of counteracts what the, you know, my bias about him as a player was. So that's kind of what it always is about, is constantly checking yourself, constantly, you know, correcting the way you are and trying to collect as much information as possible so that when you get to these last couple of weeks, you know, you feel the most confident that you've kind of vetted every single bias and collected all the information and put it together.
For sure. Tracy's been one that I've had an internal struggle with him as well, because the numbers are there, obviously, even the underlying data. But when you watch him play, he doesn't seem like a player that has one single skill that really shouts top six player. And if he's not going to be a top six player, is he going to be an effective producer? But, you know, it's true that he did have the strong U18s, and you see the numbers and you see that he's one of these guys that the puck does seem to fall around the ice a little bit. He does play with good players, and that's obviously going to help him. But he's a really interesting one, and there's several of these every class where you kind of flip-flop around and you go back and you watch tape and you really try to see, can you project them going forward? And like we're kind of going back to, is that if you knew these players as individuals too, is that, you know, is this one of these kids that's just burning desire in his belly that he wants to be better, that he's going to he's going to make it and he's going to be productive. And knowing them would shed a lot of light on that too. But it's what makes it so much fun. If this was a slam dunk and, you know, the best player always went first overall and the worst went whatever 217th, you know, it wouldn't be any fun and we wouldn't have anything to talk about out here. So even the best in the world, they make mistakes and they have their big hits and their big misses. And that's what makes it so enjoyable.
Well, yeah. And, you know, on that whole note of big hits and big misses, each one of you guys, give us a couple of hits and a couple of misses going through the process that really you, well, number one, are very proud of course. I mean, when you get a big hit, everybody enjoys hitting a grand slam or a home run, but also sometimes a couple of misses where that shed some light on you that made you learn from it. And we'll start with what you have there, Cam.
Yeah, so I've got a few nice hits that you can, you know, dust your shoulders up a little bit. I got several misses too, so don't worry about that. But I just started doing some lists back in 2013. I didn't have Twitter. I didn't have any presence out there whatsoever. But my buddies will remember, anyways, is that me talking up Jake Guentzel. I loved Jake Guentzel. I wanted the Canucks to go ahead and get themselves a second round pick anywhere in the second round to go and snag him. Of course, they didn't. He went 77th and he scored 40 goals this year. So he was when I first kind of got on that whole adopted son sort of thing, the joke that where you grab a player and you really take them under your wing and you try to champion them up for whatever reasons. And so he was a little bit small. And player in the scouts just didn't really like him that much. And I just loved the way he shot the puck, the way he saw the ice. He just seemed to find that soft spots and he could finish. And so I really, really liked Jake Guentzel. And so I had him probably ranked in the early 30s, which looking back now isn't high enough. But for a kid that went late third, that I feel pretty good about that one.
Yeah. I get asked this question quite a bit. And it's quite, you kind of have to be pretty self-reflective about it, but, for the misses, the two that have kind of stood out to me more recently is Ryan Poehling, the Montreal Canadiens prospect. I thought he was a player that didn't really offer any sort of offensive upside. I thought he, you know, maybe projected to be a bottom six center just because of the size, but he's taken really big step forwards in the NCAA and had a standout performance at the World Juniors. Then obviously had that fantastic debut, with the Canadians to kind of close out the season. So he's definitely someone wrong. You know, to kind of always loop back to the Canucks, there's Hunter Shinkarik was a player that I was wrong about. I was really, really high on him. You know, the article that I have out there about the Marcus Granlund trade and Hunter Shinkarik trade is out there in my infamy, and people like to definitely bring it up. And for that one, what I learned is that the ability for players to translate their offensive skills from junior to AHL and then AHL to the NHL and how that can be different. And that was a good learning curve for me. In terms of players that, you know, I probably, you know, got right. I'm not usually a huge fan of trying to, you know, pat in the back too much there. but the one that stands out to me kind of looking back is Sam Steele. I know there's a lot of players a lot of, you know, public rankings that weren't particularly high on him. And he was a player that I just, you know, I kind of raved about and I thought it would be. And then also Nicholas Hague from 2017 is that he was a player that many projected to be outside of the first round. And we firmly had him in the first round. And looking back on it after his first AHL season, I'm feeling pretty confident that he's going to be with the Knights in no time. And I think it's going to be part of the reason why they were willing to trade Branstrom from Mark Stone at the deadline.
The biggest miss for me and the one that kills me to this day is missing out on Braden Point. And so I liked him better than the third round. Anyways, I had him in the 40s. But, you know, if I really took my time and I really dug into him, he should have been in the teens anyways. And so that clearly now the kid put up 90 points or something this year, too, that many, many people were wrong, including a ton of NHL GMs, which does lessen the load a little bit. But he checked all the boxes of the things that I like and that I focus on. And so that was just a clear miss on my part. Another kid I missed out on was Philip Hedel. That was more of I didn't have a ton of views on him. And some of the views I had, they weren't that great. They didn't stand out to me. And obviously, I think that's wrong, too. I think that kid has top line upside. Last year, I had Brady Tkachuk ninth, which, you know, isn't the end of the world. And it's just a year later. But I didn't think he'd be so impactful so quickly. So that was another one that I missed out on. You know, I'm happy about getting Quinn Hughes at three. I had Miro Heiskanen at two. Another later guy I really liked was Brandon Montour. So I had him in the early second and he went, I think, late third or even I think he was a third rounder. But that was a kid who I thought he had that speed and his developmental arc was just skyrocketing at that time. And I don't have the numbers in front of me here, but I feel like he went from the USHL to the NHL in something like 18 months or 19 months or something crazy like this. So I was a big fan of Brandon Montour and I like that one too on my board.
Well, those are both impressive lists. And when you look at the misses, everybody's going to have misses. That's the reality. And what do scouts generally say? What percentage of prospects do you really hit on when you draft? Like, what's a good drafting team? How many picks do you get right in an average draft?
The benchmark generally is 2 out of 7 picks, so about 15%, which I think is weird in a best way to say it. I think that, I think that the teams need to strive better for being, more successful, and they are trying to do so. But I also find that a lot of people kind of are like, yeah, well, we got 2 players out of there, so that's a good draft class. And so I think that we're going to see in the next couple of years as teams are going to adapt the way they're going to do things and try to find any sort of inefficiencies in the market to try to exploit that. And hopefully that they'll rise to more 3 out of 4 and that will raise the benchmark. But that's kind of that's the general overriding theme when you kind of talk to anyone in and around the game, is that 2 out of 7 is an okay draft.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it is a low bar, but the old saying goes that you can't miss on your first round pick. So that should be a layup for most teams. You know, once you get into the 20s, things can get a little hazy. But then if you're hitting on your first and you're pulling a player out of the second or the third, that generally, yeah, you're getting that little backpack that was decent. 3, you're very pleased. Anything above that, then that's just a slam dunk, huge draft for many teams. And like Ryan said, that, every team should be looking to find those market inefficiencies and to just go through their entire organization. And, there's a cap for all nice players, but there isn't for the scouting staff and for player development and all those things where you can just spend and spend and spend, and it's only going to help your future. And I think that a lot of these big market teams have figured that out, obviously. And so I think some of the small market teams are going to be handcuffed in that regard a little bit, but as long as you're allocating your money in the right direction and you're finding these players. So, you look at the Bruins right now, who they've been good for a decade. It's because they've drafted so well. Like, obviously we can all point at 2015 and laugh, but they find talent, they've done it. And because of that, they come out of these drafts with 2, 3, 4, 5 players that are becoming NHLers and some of them impact NHLers. And that's how you stay competitive long-term. And otherwise, good teams are going to be drafting later. And obviously the percentage just goes down for you finding a good player at your spot. And so that if you're not, it's not going to last long and your window is going to close. And so it's so imperative to find these players, to find a gem in the fifth, to pull a kid out of the sixth, maybe even 2 in a draft that can end up playing on your team. Even if it's 4 or 5 years down the road, that's still a victory for the squad.
Speaking of those gems, we are going to talk about some underrated prospects that both of you guys like. Cam Robinson, Ryan Beach, myself, Satyar Shah, here on Prospect Central on Sportsnet 650. We had fun going through the process of how to evaluate players and their draft rankings here on Prospect Central on Sportsnet 650. Cam Robinson, Ryan Beach, and myself, Satyar Shah. And that's the process itself. And we talked about some past hits and misses from you guys. And one of the topics that we are going to get into now is underrated prospects that you guys really like ahead of the 2019 draft. And I know, Ryan, you are regularly on the playbook, and we talk about underrated and top-rated prospects all the time, so I know you've gone through this exercise a few different times, but there are always players that kind of emerge even a bit later on that all of a sudden you grow a greater affinity for.
Yeah, and I'm trying to give different names each time other than kind of repeating the same ones, but yeah, so the ones that kind of stand out to me, and I kind of mentioned the first half there, is that I focus more on the WHL this year just because of proximity. So it's a lot easier to get live viewings, which I was trying to make sure I did more of. And of those WHL players that have stood out to me, there's Giovanni Fairbrother with the Everett Silvertips, a nice puck-moving defenseman who skates well, had a good second half in the season. Henry Rubinsky with the Seattle Thunderbirds, I'm pretty high on him. He was over a point a game player when he was finally given an opportunity with the Thunderbirds and seized the opportunity, and he really jumps out if you isolate just that half of the season. So those are kind of the guys that stand out to me from this side. And then, I can kind of go through the list. Like I mentioned, Jordan Spence before is a player I like. Adam Beckman is another player here in the WHL who had a strong second half. And then kind of looking over on the other side of the pond is, I think, Simone Holmstrom is a player who's been underlooked because he was battling injury. And I think he had a really strong U18s, which kind of reasserted everything. And I think he's a player that is going to go higher than people expect. And then there's a lot of the kind of the depth forwards with the U.S. program. Michael Gildon,
John Beecher, Henry Thrun. I think those three are the kind of the ones that stand out to me as, you know, depth players who can do things sliding up and down the lineups anywhere, who probably, in my opinion, might be better than some of the higher profile players like Alex Vlasic, on defense specifically. So those are kind of the guys that stand out to me. And I probably lastly with Carl Henriksen in there, he had a fantastic U18s, and we don't want to have too much recency bias, but, you know, he still was over a point per game in the junior league there in Sweden. So it's not like I'm just basing that solely off that, you know, that 2 week tournament.
Yeah, nice. That's an interesting list of guys. I had a couple of those guys too. I really like Jordan Sprentz. Fairbrother, he's a really interesting player, and he can throw hands too. The guy, he's not afraid to kind of mix it up too. So he's kind of a fun one for sure. A few guys that Ryan didn't mention there that I like. I like Patrick Pistola, Finnish kid. He's got nice set of skills. I think he has that top six upside. He's more of a goal scorer, but he had a really nice year playing in Finland over there in the top league. He played some games up in the Liga. Another Finnish kid that I really like too is Tuukka Tiksula, a smaller undersized kid, very, very, very quick. He has nice speed, quick hands, offensive skills through the nine sort of thing. He needs to thicken up. He needs to get stronger so he can get banged off of the pucks. He can lose those board battles on the power play. He's just deadly, a really, really fun player to watch. Just high-end vision. So he's one that I really enjoy. Jameson Rees. So he's a kid that I had higher on my board throughout the season. He kind of dropped down. He had a difficult second half. He's battled injuries throughout his OHL career, but the kid is just a gamer. So he's got great wheels. He showcased that at the U18s there too, that he's just tenacious. He's a great penalty killer. He's got offensive upside. He's one of these kids that if he can kind of knock the Band-Aid label that's kind of been put on him lately, and be a player that can stay healthy. And I think he could really be a contributing member. I think he's got energy line written all over him with some upside too. So, you know, maybe he does have that top six upside. Another guy is Dominic Fensori. He's undersized with the U.S. National Team Development Program, but just a really fun player to watch. Can skate like the wind. Another kid, 5'9", Nick Abruzzese. So he's a double overager, but he led the USHL in points. He's got a lot of talent too. Now, you know, looking at a kid who's 19 and playing in the USHL, you better lead that league in scoring if you're going to have an opportunity to get drafted. And I think he will. I was chatting with a scout there, Russ Cohen, just the other day. He's got him in his first round. He loves this kid as a double overager. And I immediately said, I'm like, he you know, you got to be the leader of his fan club right now. But yeah, he had a good laugh about that. And but I like him more in the third or fourth round, but I think he's got the upside to be an NHL player. I think he's heading to Harvard next season, which will be nice to see. Those are some players that really stand out to me that I like a lot. And I think they're not getting as much love on most public lists anyways. And I think they've got some nice upside.
Well, you know, we'll go through a few of these guys individually a little bit. But Ryan, one of the things I wanted to ask you before we get into that, and just kind of listing off all these players that Cam mentioned and you mentioned, how big is the list this year when you look at players that could actually be decent players? Can it go all the way to 60 to 70? Because usually people talk about drafts like, yeah, we'll scout about 100 guys, but we usually think about 40 to 50 are real players. The rest you're just taking a bit of a crapshoot. Is it a bit of a wider net this year?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a really interesting draft class. I think that the top 10-ish are have all chances to be impact players, and then there's kind of a step down from there, and then it's a really weird kind of group from 10 to 35-ish is that the, you know, they're not, you know, there's definite tiers to it, but it's definitely, there's not as much excitement to a lot of these players. There's a lot more questions, but then after that I find that there's a lot of players that I'm easily adding onto the pile by the end of the day. So, you know, like, there's, I would probably lean towards there being 70 players out of this group that I could comfortably say project to be an NHL player, but it'll be really interesting to see kind of how it goes and how it, once they're taken, you know, what happens with them.
Yeah, player development is so big. And I think Ryan's right. This is an interesting class because it's not super elite at the top. It does have some very nice talent up there. And then it's just kind of got a really mixed bag where there's players with some deficiencies, whether it's, you know, they're not overly big. They're maybe a little one-dimensional, or they are good defensive players, but maybe they don't have high offensive skills. So there might be 70 guys in this class that could realistically push to be NHL players if things break right for them. But at the same time, there might be 30, 35. So you really don't know. And it's kind of a long-term view. And so when it gets to that point in the draft, when you're on day two, is go for upside and trust your scouts, obviously, and trust these guys that know these players and go to bat for these players and say, like, you know, he has a deficiency, but we think he can push past it because X, Y, and Z, and go big on players. And I've always said this, is that if you're going to take a swing on a guy that maybe he's going to be a player that can impact the game in a positive way, rather than hoping that you're going to pull a guy that when he's 23, 24, he can be a call up and play on your fourth line, or he can be a depth defenseman for you, that maybe he can be an eight or a seven guy sort of thing, is that take a chance on these kids that, you know, they've got the hands, they've got the quickness, maybe they're a little undersized, but if they can push past that and they can break through, that maybe they're a top six contributor or a top four D-man or something like that.
Well, we always see how many good players come out of the second round, especially. And one player that you mentioned, Cam, was Patrick Pistola. And I want to get Ryan's take on him as well. But when you look at players that can come out of the second round, and I want to maybe focus on a few of those guys you mentioned that kind of fit in that second, maybe early third round range. But Patrick Pistola, Ryan, how intriguing is he when you start digging through the metrics?
He's a really intriguing player. So, you know, I kind of alluded to the list of players that we have for the underlying data. And one of the things we use is the prospect graduation system. So we kind of look at players and their probability of success. And usually there's a handful of players that won't have matches. And that means that players of the same size at the same age didn't put up the same points as them for a variety of reasons. And that can be because they're a small player, a big player, you know, they put up astronomical numbers. An example of that is Elias Pettersson, is that he put up such high numbers in his draft season that he had no comparable players, and that's kind of what set him apart. And so the long way of getting to that point is that Patrick Pistola is a player that kind of is at the top of the group of this draft class. There's about nine players who don't have any matches, and he's one of them, just because of how well he did at the second level in Finland, putting up the 26 points in 22 games, and then getting a cup of tea in the Liga as well for 16 games. So he's a really intriguing player. I've liked his game in terms of his viewings. He just seems to have all the attributes that you're kind of looking for in a player that can, you know, kind of slide anywhere in your top six as a left winger. And another encouraging sign is that he still has some more strength and size, more strength and weight to add to his frame, which I think, given his frame, I don't think it'll hold him back from all the things he does really well.
Yeah, I think that's spot on the kid, that he did have just a really strong year in the Métis, and that's not an easy league to play in. And we often see that I feel that it's nice to look at kind of the J20, the Super Elite there in Sweden, or, you know, you can look at the Junior ASM Liga in Finland, and you can see these kids that put up big numbers over a point per game. And you're like, yeah, that's nice. And it is, you know, when they're playing in a U20 league and junior in their country, and they're putting up big numbers, that's nice. But the Allsvenskan and the Métis, I find that it's undervalued a little bit, where a kid goes up there and like Pistola put up over a point a game, and he mimicked that in the playoffs too. And then he obviously had a really nice under-18s. But putting up those numbers in that league, like, that's a professional league with men in it. Same with the Allsvenskan. That's a high-level league. And when you can put up numbers like that, and I feel like that was part of the reason that Pettersson didn't really blow up in his draft year, is that he had the great numbers in the Allsvenskan. He didn't show up that much, I wouldn't say, internationally. Like, he was good, but he wasn't tremendous. And so I think maybe scouts that watched him internationally and kind of had a bit of a lukewarm feel to him, or they're not putting the stock into the difficulty of the league that they're playing in. And I love it when a player in his draft year at 17 can play against men and succeed and really dictate the pace of play. And they're not out there just as a passenger and kind of deferring to their older, more mature line mates, but they're taking charge. They're setting the pace of play. They're deciding what's going to happen. They're, you know, seeing the situations happen in front of them and, you know, taking control of things and putting up those pink points. And I put a great deal of stock into that. And so a kid like Pistola is that I've liked him a lot playing in Finland. I've had him in my second round for a long time here. Is that a little glimpse into June, is that he's sitting in round one right now. And I think he's going to be fairly firm in that position moving forward.
Well, it's going to be intriguing to see where he essentially goes. And obviously one Finnish player who went in the second round is having a lot of success in the postseason is Sebastian Aho. And if you want to talk about a high-end talent that was stolen at number 35, and it's unfair to ask, okay, who's going to be the next Sebastian Aho out of this class? But outside of that, Cam, outside of Pistola, who may go in the first but maybe goes in the second, is there a player you look at that has extremely high upside that could end up being a star player that comes out of the second round, kind of?
Oh man, that is a tough one for sure. There are some kids that I really like that are going to go in round two for sure. I don't see any Sebastian Ahos, because if I did, they'd be in round one.
Yes,
for sure.
Absolutely.
But there is a kid that I like, and he's been right on the cusp of round one, kind of maybe in the 40s up into the low 30s. Samuel Poulin, and this kid, he's 6'1", 208, playing in the queue. He is just a matchup nightmare. So he's just out there battling all the time in the defensive end, and it leads to scoring chances the other way. He's got a heavy, heavy release. And I just see it like he's working in the offensive zone, and they can't get the puck off him. And it's not because he's that much bigger. 6'1", 210, like, he's strong for the Q. His skating needs to improve a little bit, but he plays just an intelligent game, which is so key. And I will look for that, those first two or three strides to quicken up for him to really have an opportunity to be a top six contributor. But I think he's one of these guys that's probably going to be around on day two, and that a team early, before the pick 40 sort of thing, that they're going to grab him. And I think they're going to really enjoy what he does. He's going to step in and probably have another monster season in the queue, and then transition up. And I think he safely projects as a guy that can play in a bottom six, and that if he can get that skating going in the right direction, that he could have a top six upside to be a guy that could score 20 plus goals and to kill penalties for you and play on the power play. And so he's a really interesting player that I've grown on throughout the year.
Yeah, it's always hard to kind of predict what's going to happen on draft day. So, talking mm-hmm. about players who could be there in round two, they could go in the first round. But for the two players that have generally been, on that cusp of the first to second round, the two players that stand out for me is Antonin Honka. He's a player that for some reason continues to see his stock fall. He was firmly as a first round pick for most of the first half of the season, and he's kind of slowly trended downwards, and now he's regularly outside of it. And I think he's a player that's prime to be selected early on second day, and that team's going to pay dividends on that, just because of the fact that he has such an intriguing skill set. He's a fantastic skater, moves the puck well. The biggest criticism for him that I've heard is that he just doesn't look like he gives and he doesn't give a crap about what's going on the ice,
right.
And that's definitely something you have to keep an eye on, but I think it's almost for the fact that he just seems to be frustrated with what's going on. So he's a player that I'm really intrigued by. One player that probably sneaks into the first round is Nils Höglander. He's someone who, if he's there early on draft day, on day two, he's I'm running up to the microphone to take him, right? So
right.
Those are kind of the players that stand out of that group, and then it kind of goes down from there. It'll be really interesting to see there, because maybe a player like Mikko Kokkonen slides out, and then he's another player that kind of had that same thought process, is that he's going to pay immediate dividends to whatever prospect pool selects him.
The interesting thing about Honka too is that Dallas took a swing on his brother, who had this similar upside, but they took him in the top 15, I believe it was. And so now you're looking at little brother Anthony, and that, because that stock has fallen, and he has, dare I say, regressed a little bit in his draft year versus his draft minus one, is that taking a chance on him at 35 is far different than taking a swing in the top 20 or top 15. And so you have that equity where you can take a swing on a kid that he can skate very, very well, and he can create offense. He gets a lot of shots on net. So I think Ryan's absolutely right that he's a divisive prospect for a lot of reasons. And if it's true that he doesn't give a shit about things out there as it seems a lot of the time, is that that's probably not going to bode well for his future. But if he can get things going the right direction, like, this is a guy who could be a real stalwart on a power play team, on a power play unit, I should say, for a lot of years.
Well, we are going to keep breaking down these prospects, and we'll go through all the players. And before you know it, everybody's going to be so familiar with the top 60 players that you'll be reeling them off with your draft buddies watching this draft coming up in Vancouver. One of the things that's always fun to do as well is kind of revisiting old drafts and kind of looking at it and say, okay, how would you redraft the top five picks, the top 10 picks in a given draft? And I know, Cam, somebody posed a question to you about redrafting the top five of the 2017 draft class.
Yeah, I hesitated to even answer it, because it's a little bit early for a redraft.
Yes.
And you're playing with fire a little bit, but I went ahead and I did it anyways, and I did preface that it is early on, so there's a lot of hockey left to be played. But I put Pettersson at number one. I got Heiskanen, I should say, at number two, where I had him on draft day. Hischier at three there, and Cale Makar at four. And I could honestly say that those top three are interchangeable for me. So I think that Nico Hischier has somehow fallen under the radar a little bit, playing in Jersey, and Taylor Hall was out this year, so he was playing on a bad team. He didn't have much help, but I honestly feel like this kid's going to play at or near a point per game pace at a Selke level for the next decade, and that has a lot of value. So anybody who wants to keep him at number one, that's okay with me. Heiskanen, I think, is just that truly elite skating defenseman that can impact the game at 30 minutes a night. That is so, so rare. So you want to put him number one again, I'm cool with that. I think Cale Makar has the most offensive upside on the back end. The way he can skate too is just phenomenal, but I don't think he's achieved enough at this point to really battle those guys. At number five, you know, you could put Nolan Patrick there, who went two. He's been somewhat underwhelming in Philadelphia offensively. I think he's taken some hard minutes and he's done fairly well. He was old for that crop, so this was 19 and 20 year for him. So next year's 21, and you're looking for a kid to put up some points with that lofty of a draft slot. But I put Robert Thomas there at number five. I think he's a player that has a very high upside and he does everything very, very well. He got a couple points there to close out the conference semis. So a big Rob Thomas fan there for me.
Yeah, my list isn't too far off. I'd put EP at number one. I'd put Heiskanen at number two. I'd put Cale Makar at number three. Then I put Hischier at four. And just to be different, because I don't want to talk about the same players, as I would put Hedel at five, just because we were, myself and a few other at Canucks Army were high on him entering into the draft year. So I want to take that victory lap and put him at number five. But I think that Patrick at five is fine and Thomas at five is fine. And you know, those are not, you know, too bad. And you could even say Yuka Harju is taking big step forwards this year as well. So, you know, that's the problem with doing it so close out, is that because development curves are different, there's so many players that are on the outside still looking in, and that could change in a few years. And then, you know, we could be talking about players in the second round of, you know, Boyquist, of Jesper Boyquist, or Formanton quickly rising up the ranks if they get an opportunity in the NHL next year.
Well, and there are players like Casey Mittelstadt, and we'll see how they do a bit later on as well. Can they figure it out? And one player that I'm very intrigued to find out, because I loved in his draft year and hasn't worked out for him, is Gabe Vilardi. And it comes down to health for him, but I gotta wonder, what do you guys think on Vilardi? Is he done, or does he still have a chance to be something?
For me, it's very concerning, a back issue at his age, and it's been lingering and it's been holding him out, and you can see it's affecting his skating when he was playing there. That is tough to recover from, and it's tough to lose developmental years, to not play at this time where strides are so big for players, and you need to take those leaps and bounds in order to keep up. He's definitely dug himself a hole. It's unfortunate, and it's out of his hands for sure. But I liked Gabe Vilardi too. He was one of the guys, though, that I said that I felt he would slide out of the top 10, even though many projected him to go four or five, just because the foot speed wasn't there. I maybe saw him a little bit more as a winger, but he had the great instincts. He had the soft hands. So, you know, it's not over for him, but Rasmus Kupari has definitely supplemented him as their top prospect and top center prospect for sure. And I think he's got a long road ahead.
Yeah, I think Cam is on point there. I think that he just suffered some really bad luck and has kind of seen his draft stock fall considerably since then, which I think is actually unfair, because I think he's still a really good player. He just, you know, had some really bad luck. And if he can kind of figure it out, I think he'll kind of reassert himself as being one of the top players from this draft class. But now we're kind of dealing with the uncertainty, so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
The last one I want to put in as a dark horse to go into number five, and I think people have kind of forgotten about him a little bit, is Martin Nikesh. This kid is very, very good. He had a great season in the AHL. He didn't show up that much at the U20s, but you know, talking from people close to the organization in Carolina, is that they are pretty steadfast that it's going to be Nikesh and Svechnikov as a duo in the NHL starting next year. And if that's the case, if they become a pair on, you know, quote unquote, a second line in Carolina, and you got Aho and Teravainen up on the top there, that's going to produce a lot of points. I'm a very big fan of Nikesh. I think he's got, you know, he probably won't be a 1C because he's going to be playing behind Aho, but he's got that kind of level. And so he's one of these guys that I think definitely could push into that conversation with Glass, with Mittelstadt, with Hedl, that can push up there. Even a kid like Eric Brandstrom, right? He's very, very talented in his own right. He's only got a couple NHL games under his belt now. So let's revisit in 2 or 3 or 10 years and see how wrong or right we were.
Yeah, and it's only a couple years out. These things can change really quickly, but I'm glad you brought up Robert Thomas and Hedl as well, Ryan, because I think those two players are really talented and they deserve some due. Well, it goes by quick when you're having fun talking hockey prospects. We'll get to more of it next week right here on Prospect Central on Sportsnet 650.